One More Cup is a coffee shop in Waldo. The interior is painted in bright candy colors, orange, blue, yellow. Drinks are served in mismatched Fiestaware mugs, and the art on the walls, well, it probably has not been market tested. Every morning and every weekend for the last 10 years, this has been a home away from home for a lot of the Waldo community. But One More Cup is open just one more weekend. The announcement of their closing has us thinking about these quirky neighborhood spots that people love and whether the new trends toward minimalism and polish are perhaps making them a bit of a rarity. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we are joined by Stacy Neff. She and her husband Jeremy are the owners of One More Cup. Stacy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you here on what I'm sure are busy last few days.
Yes, very busy.
It must be strange to know that your coffee shop, this thing that you've poured your life into for the last 10 years, is closing after this weekend.
It's a little strange, though Jeremy and I came to this decision at the start of the summer, so we had some time to process it, but now we've been, you know, helping others process it.
How much is it really a 24/7 sort of operation for you?
Well, I mean, our hours are, you know, only half the day, so about, say, 6:30 a.m. to 7 p.m.
But
for us, I mean, Jeremy's the one that gets the calls in the middle of the night if someone's sick and can't make their shift, or, you know, we run out of something critical and, you know, you could be at home trying to do something else and you need to suddenly go get it. So pretty much we're almost always on call.
So that's a big change then. I wonder what it's like for your regulars. A coffee shop is a very personal place. There's a real community there. How are they holding up?
They're taking it better, you know, than maybe I expected a little. But, I mean, you know, a lot of people are sad and upset, but they're also very understanding. And, you know, we've just really seen such an amazing outpouring that's been kind of hard for us to wrap our heads around just how nice everyone's been about the whole thing since we broke the news.
And what do you think that outpouring is about? What is the need that this place was filling in people's lives?
Well, it's a lot more than just a good drink.
Right, because you can get coffee some other places.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, you know, there are some unique drinks that people are very attached to, or, you know, certain baked goods or things like that. But really, we've just been overwhelmed by how much people noticed and are acknowledging the We just really wanted to create a comfortable, safe community space for all kinds of people to gather. And it's been amazing to see the connections made over the last 10 years.
I wonder if it turned out to be what you thought it would be. Did you create it to be exactly what it became?
I think so. I mean, I think we kind of succeeded maybe more in that than we thought we would. But it was always a goal of ours to create a community space where people can gather and also to be active out in our community and we've done a lot of fundraisers for nonprofits and supported a lot of schools and other things like that. So,
and I know that's been part of what's been important to you about it, this sort of community connections you've made there, right?
Oh, yes, that's a big part.
And how does that how does that get replaced? I mean, is that something that just sort of goes away when a business goes away?
Well, I mean, you know, we won't be out there as a business specifically doing that anymore, though individually we're both motivated to stay active in our community and serve in different ways. And we just hope also to always be an example to other businesses that there's so much that you receive from customers. I mean, besides just straight up money, you know, but that there are people supporting you, supporting your vision. And I think it's really important to give back. And I just hope that I think a lot of other businesses recognize that too, and already do those things themselves as well.
You know, we alluded a little bit to the aesthetic or the vibe of the place, and it's not necessarily conventional. A lot of new places sort of, I don't know, they take on a very similar look, sort of the sleek subway tiles and wood accents. That's what I think about when a new coffee shop opens. That's what I expect it to look like. You've gone with something different.
We're a little 90s. We always say, like, maybe have that. I mean, really, we always looked at the shop as an extension of our home. And For anyone who's been into our personal home, it is very quirky and mismatched. And, you know, we have a lot of art and a lot of music and a lot of all kinds of things. And so it was just very important to us to be true to ourselves, knowing that, I mean, it is a representation of ourselves. And it was a space that we would be in as much as our home. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of places in Kansas City, I think, at one time at least, felt like that. The little business was a reflection of the people who were running it. Do you feel like that is going by the wayside to some extent?
I mean, maybe it's hard to know, not knowing every owner, you know, personally, deeply. And there are a lot of trends that get focused on. And I mean, I'm sure that definitely fits into some people's personal aesthetics and lifestyles and things like that. But, you know, I think a lot don't focus on maybe as many personal touches that really reflect mm-hmm. their characters.
And how do you feel about that? I mean, the fact that that's changing.
I mean, to me, I like quirky. I like weird. I love seeing people be themselves and be free and open. But I also understand, I mean, I enjoy, you know, fancy, slick shops, too, or just, you know, I'm out there for all of it. Mm-hmm. So it is a little sad. Like, I'm always rooting for the sidelines, I guess. But
it feels like coffee shops in particular are a thing where there's a sharp contrast between the so-called mom and pop place that reflects an individual owner's personality and the evil empires of massive as they are often portrayed.
But, you know, there's space for all of it. And the main thing is, I think, just I always hope people find a place that, you know, where people are nice. They and all those places have people who are kind and where they enjoy the drinks. And there's just a space for everyone out there.
Do you think there are other places in Waldo or elsewhere in town that occupy kind of the same sort of space that you are now leaving?
Oh, there's a lot of quirky in Waldo, I'll tell you that.
Well, and so you fit your neighborhood in that way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's kind of going through a transfer. I mean, there's some, you know, kind of cooler, slicker places coming in, but there's space for all of that. And, you know, and I feel like when things close up, I mean, I've seen a lot of places that fall in that vein over the years close up. And but then there's always something that springs new. So who knows what'll be out there in the next year to 5 years or further down the line.
I didn't actually ask. Why are you closing?
Well, we're tired.
Fair enough.
It's a hard lifestyle, and we've been doing it for 10 years. And we just, I mean, that's really the thing. And it feels good to be in control of it. It's not, you know, it's not that people aren't supporting us enough or that, you know, we have to for some reason. It's more just being ready for different paths in our lives. So.
And what will those different paths be?
Well, my husband has been a piano tuner all along. And so he's really going to focus on building that back up because he's done it all along but hasn't been able to pour as much into it. And he also has a fair amount of library experience, so maybe looking into getting back into that world a little bit. Or, you know, he hasn't 100% landed on that other piece. And then for me, I would love to jump into the nonprofit world somehow. I'm just not sure exactly what that is. That's the part we don't really know fully yet. So it's kind of like jumping off a cliff and know that we can, that it'll work out. But yeah, we're still figuring that component out. And it'll be easier once the shop is fully closed and we can focus on that.
Sounds like the way you ran the shop with whatever clutter it had and whatever sort of lack of organization it publicly presented is something that, as you're saying, sort of reflects you're okay with that. You're okay with not being sure what the next step is.
We are. I think we're both a little, I guess, risky or whatever. And we own the building and that's actually the first focus is we have a lot of interest in both the building and the business itself. So there may be another coffee shop moving in there that has elements or maybe not elements of our shop. And so really being able to focus on that And that gives us some time to then figure out what we want to do.
Do you have wisdom that you would impart to people who want to create spaces for communities the way that you have done for Waldo with One More Cup?
I think I think it's always important to just be true to yourself and to not be afraid to just do things. There's always things out in the community that need help. Like we just, we would have people reach out to us sometimes, you know, schools needing donations or things like that, and just trying to support those as much as we could. But also, like, I got it in me to organize about a year ago a snack drive for the KCMO public schools for during their MAP testing and a kind note drive with that to give to the children. So, you know, just... if you think of something, do it.
Yeah. Well, Stacy Neff, good luck to you. Thanks for the last 10 years.
Thank you very much.
Stacy and her husband, Jeremy, own One More Cup in Waldo, which is closing at the end of this weekend. September 1st is the last day. I'm Brian Ellison. Up next, we'll hear about Kansas City's first Black Restaurant Week. It's coming up in September, and it's coming up in just a minute here on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman on KCUR's Central Standard. Next week is Kansas City's first official Black Restaurant Week. You know that effort's actually been going on unofficially for a while. We're going to hear what's prompted Kansas City to start a Black Restaurant Week, and we'll talk about race in the restaurant business more generally and how we fit into that in the national picture. Let's start the conversation here at home, though, with Quez Beasley. He's been coordinating the restaurants for next week. Quez, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
It's great to have you here. So,
thank you for having us.
I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with KC Restaurant Week. What is Black Restaurant Week?
Kansas City Black Restaurant is all Black-owned businesses, restaurants, actually here in Kansas City. And so we really wanted to highlight a lot of Black restaurants here in Kansas City, in Kansas, actually. So that's what Kansas City Black Restaurant is.
So it's both sides of the state line.
Both sides of the state line, yes, sir.
How many restaurants do you have participating so far?
Right now it's like 8 or 9. We just got 8 or 9. We're doing something every day of the week.
Okay.
Next year I want it to be even bigger, but we really got Niecy's is one of them. She's been around for decades. So we have people who have been around in the Black restaurant industry forever. And then we got the newcomers, too.
So is this something you heard about in other cities, or is this a totally original
actually,
idea?
Kansas City Black Restaurant is going on in other cities also. It's in Texas. It's in New Orleans. A lot of people doing it. So Kansas City, we're like, let's jump on board and let's do it here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Why is this so important to do?
I think you should always celebrate your origin, where you came from, your heritage. And it's just any race, honestly, just not Black Restaurant Week, but it's something that we're celebrating. Sometimes we're overlooked, you know, and sometimes restaurants are overlooked. So we really want to celebrate not just Black, but everybody, and everybody can come, you know? So that's what we really want to stress.
Excellent. Well, let's talk more about that, but let me first turn to Reggie Gray. He was the founding director of Black Privilege KC, which is an app that helps Black business owners in Kansas City connect with each other. It also helps customers who want to support Black businesses get to know who's out there and what services they offer and so on. Reggie is still a spokesperson for Black Privilege KC, even though he's moved on to his own business ventures. Reggie, welcome.
Hey, Brian. Excited to be here today.
It is always good to have you. And I know you've worked with Black business owners in Kansas City. What are your observations about the need that exists for something like Black Restaurant Week?
Well, first of all, I'm so excited about Quest and Black Restaurant Week being in Kansas City. And like you alluded to earlier, Brian, this city has really been amazing in the support. A lot of people don't realize how much we do support one another here and the inclusivity of this city. So there's already been... I won't say Black Restaurant Week, but there have been different organizations that have done things similar. But for this to be on a national level, it is exciting that they're focusing on Kansas City.
And I mean, in your experience, is there something about Kansas City and how this plays out, how race plays out in the restaurant industry that's distinct, that's unique and different?
Well, one thing I will say is this, Brian. When we launched our mobile app technology, we learned a lot. And our founder is from LA and our advisors are from the coast. We were blown away when we found out how many Black-owned restaurants there actually are in the greater Kansas City area.
Yeah.
Our database, we already have over 100. And out of those hundreds, it is probably at least a dozen that are actually on a scalable level, multiple locations, been in business 10 plus years. And just speaking about restaurants in general, that is probably the highest risk investment you can be in. The turnover rate is high. Most fail within the first 2 years. Right. So just to own and open a restaurant, I don't care what color you are, is a feat and challenge in itself. So this is a big deal.
It is a big deal. I want to talk about that, about how the ownership of restaurants reflects Kansas City's racial diversity, or how it doesn't, but also customers in those restaurants. And joining us as our next guest is Todd Kleiman. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. by phone. He's an author, a former food writer. He once taught at Howard University, and he's written about race in D.C. restaurants. Probably some of what he's written applies to other places, too. Todd, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So I want to ask you first, as you listen to my other guests this morning talk about Black Restaurant Week in Kansas City, how much of what they've shared about the need for this kind of event resonates with you?
Well, I think it's very important, and it's very hard, as has been pointed out, to run a restaurant, and most fail within 2 years. I think the failure rate is something like 90%. It's extraordinarily hard. The margins are very slim, even when restaurants are getting by. And we know that Black-owned businesses struggle. It's an extra layer of hard. It's something then that, as I've seen in the D.C. area, in Richmond, Virginia, and in other cities, it's something that can shine light on businesses that, folks who are outside of this world can see and say, "Oh, let's take a look. Let's throw some support." And in a city like Richmond, for example, I think most of those restaurants there experienced some kind of a bump after Black Restaurant Week. So for 3 or 4 months, they were doing better numbers than they had done prior, which is great. It's a terrific thing to see. And then what you hope is to see more of that, more restaurants in the mix each year, and for it to keep building. Having said that, though, I think what I would like to see is an effort put on the entire restaurant world as a whole, and for some of this kind of effort to be directed to the larger system of restaurants in cities and across the country.
And so by that, you mean not just highlighting Black-owned businesses, but things like opportunities for Black chefs or Black people to have leadership in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, when you go into restaurants, and I spent 15 years eating out across the country
as a food critic.
Nationally and locally, 500 plus times a year. So I ate out more than anyone really ought to, and. The picture was pretty much the same no matter what the city I went to. And Washington, D.C. has a sizable African-American population, but that population was not seen really on the restaurant scene at the time I was making my rounds.
Well, and I want to talk about that in this really widely read article you wrote. I couldn't believe it was 4 years ago, but it's been anthologized. It's called Coding and Decoding Dinner. And you talk about how you went around and you counted faces. Say what you mean by that.
Well, it's complicated, but as you mentioned, I used to teach at Howard University. I was a professor of English and writing, and that experience was eye-opening for me in a lot of ways. And one of those ways was that I was a child of the 80s, and that was the era of color blindness. And when I got to Howard, my students were imploring me. They were saying, "We want you to notice color. We want you to notice us. We want you to notice the ways in which we are different from you and for people with your skin."
And you are a white man. We haven't actually noted that yet, but yes.
Well, right, and that was something that my upbringing, my training, my whole education had been working against. So things were in static, and of course that was one reason why I wanted to teach at Howard, because you want to constantly, as a writer, and as a thinker, as a teacher, to be challenged. So counting became kind of a thing that I did. It wasn't so much counting was what I was interested in doing, but I was interested in noticing, and in understanding why there was such a disparity. Why I would come from a world like Howard, and then go on to the restaurant world of the city and just see that there's such a disparity. Well, and when I would count, I would very seldom see people of color in restaurants at a certain level, and really at all levels. And here's a city that is, at the time, was majority African American, and those numbers were not bearing out on the restaurant scene.
And as you dug into this, you kept hearing again and again that chefs, mostly white chefs, had some thoughts about the racial composition of their dining rooms. That's what I understand.
Not exactly. It's something that restaurateurs, the owners, would talk about on the down low. I mean, it took me about 10 years of reporting to put this all together because people would not talk on the record. But it was something I kept hearing about, a 60-40 rule, kind of an unwritten 60-40 rule, whereby, as people had it, as I was able to piece it together, if a dining room became more than 60% black or of color, then quickly it became close to 100%. And so restaurateurs were saying, in effect, and on the down low, that this is something that they wanted to avoid.
I'm going to stop you there. We'll definitely come back to you. Stick around. But I want to ask my guests here, who are very active in the Kansas City restaurant scene, whether what Todd Kleiman is talking about does it ring true here?
Me being an African American young male here in Kansas City, just saying that, number one, we're not given a lot of opportunities as everybody else. You know, and it's
including
just,
in things like business,
including business, cooks, being a manager of a restaurant. Yeah. We're not given. So sometimes we got to work a bit harder than everybody else, you know. And so him saying these numbers, he's saying, OK, I don't see a black cook right there, or I don't see this person right here. And it's good that he got to see that, you know, and that lets you know that we have more to do, and that's why we're shining the light on Kansas City Black restaurants. What do you think,
Reggie?
First of all, excellent research you've done, Todd. And my mother is a graduate from Howard University, and I'm from Baltimore, so nothing but love, my brother. Now, in saying that, I completely understand what Todd is saying in regards to If the majority of your base are African Americans, the concern could be what is going to be the longevity right. of that. Right. And some of the top black restaurateurs and entrepreneurs will always say, I don't want to be the best black owned business. I want to be the best business. Right. I want to be the best restaurant. And they create branding and marketing that is inclusive to that. So, and also in speaking about the lack of diversity amongst customers, that's a problem that African Americans have been fighting for yes. decades, if not centuries, mm-hmm. in regards to the circulation of the dollar. Mm-hmm. Black folk are powerful. We have 1.3 trillion plus in buying power, yet we only spend 2% of that back into the black community. Right. Mm-hmm. That is a major problem. The biggest employer of African Americans are black-owned businesses, yet we don't even support our own businesses. Mm-hmm. That's why our founder created the mobile app, to try to increase spending amongst all businesses, not just restaurants. But unfortunately, and I could see this on the coast even more so,
right.
that if the majority of your base is black, what is going to be your sustainability yes. just as an entrepreneur?
Right.
Why diversity is so important.
Todd?
And one thing that Peace talks about is the idea that just because restaurants are theoretically open spaces, theoretically welcoming spaces, we call it the hospitality industry, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that everybody's welcome. Restaurants have always been coded spaces. And I'm not using coded in the old sense of the term. I mean literally coded spaces that they are designed and sometimes very carefully designed with architects, with sound engineers, with lighting designers, to appeal to certain demographics mm-hmm. and to keep others out. Restaurants have always been, in some respect, an us versus them operation. But the thing that I think is really important here is that up and down the line in the restaurant world, opportunities exist. And what I would love to
Well, can I? I mean, can I stop you before you go on, Todd? I mean, what do you mean by coding? I want to get real specific. What's an example of a way that a restaurant is coded to say what we're really trying to have here is white customers or customers of color?
Well, no, it's not. It's not that simplistic. So, if you, for example, I mean, you have this kind of restaurant style throughout the country. If you see exposed brick and you see, you know, the dangling Edison light bulb, and you hear alt rock playing on the sound system, and these things are meant to send codes. I mean, they're not.
And what's the code? What is it saying?
That's designed to appeal to somebody probably between 25 and 35, largely white and fairly well traveled. That is, in other words, it's not sending out a signal that that this is a restaurant. And again, this is being very simplistic about it, and the piece gets more in depth. But it's not sending a broad signal. It's not sending a signal that, first of all, when you have brick walls and exposed light, it's not a very comfortable experience. So you get folks who are getting up there in age, and they're in their 60s and 70s. That space is going to be very loud. It's not going to be very comfortable. There's a lot of hard surfaces. So that space is saying, not for you. There's nothing wrong with that inherently, but restaurants are always doing things, particularly at a certain level, to send those signals and to do them very invisibly.
Well, okay, and I want to stop because Mark Quez, you've been in these businesses, these restaurants that you're lining up here for Black Restaurant Week.
Yes.
You know, Todd used the language of the way restaurants are set up is to make someone comfortable there. Mm-hmm. What's comfortable is going to be different for different people. Mm-hmm. How does this play out with Black owned restaurants in Kansas City?
I actually love some of what he said, actually. And think about it. A restaurant was first used for people to come to with their families to sit down and to celebrate something, to celebrate life. We don't even see a lot of that no more. And I like how he said with the music, everything, you might hear different music, and you have that's to some being a, say if I was a Black-owned restaurant and I wanted white customers, I can't play certain music. And it is the music sometimes that's going to attract the people. Some people like to see the ambiance of how a restaurant look. It all goes into that. Some people, the food is it's bigger than a restaurant.
But you can't play it because if you do, the white customers won't come.
You never know. You know, that's something that it can go back and forth because music is not a race. You know, I don't think music would be a factor of restaurants. I just think that each restaurant is different. Mm-hmm. Playing music can affect your money and your business.
Yeah. Reggie, as you listen to this, you've spent a whole lot of time promoting Black-owned businesses. Is this a good thing or a bad thing, or is this just how it is?
I think a part of it is this is how it is. Yeah. I think the coding goes on both sides. Weirdly,
right?
I think it's Black-owned businesses that are setting up their own coding to where they want to focus on their target demographic or who they know they can promote to.
And do you feel like Black-owned restaurants in Kansas City are targeting the African-American community primarily because of just the way the numbers have played out historically?
I definitely think there are a percentage of Black-owned businesses that do. But then when you look at, and I don't want to say names, but when you look at the Black-owned restaurants that are more successful, that have scaled, they are very careful because the majority of their dollars don't come from us.
Mm-hmm.
They're non-Black dollars. So they're very careful in how they not only from the music, to the ambiance, to the marketing, even from what I remember one of the legends of Kansas City. I won't say his name, but I met him last year, owns multiple locations, is the legend of barbecue. Y'all probably know who I'm talking about.
you've narrowed it down.
I narrowed it down, I know. And I pretty much asked him a question. It's so weird. On camera about Black-owned businesses. And his answer was so methodical, careful, strategic, and that was my wake-up call to, we say a lot of things about color,
right,
but it's bigger than color, right. It's the haves and the have-nots,
right.
It's those who have the money, those who have the education,
right.
Those who have the power. So even though we break a lot of stuff down in color, it's much bigger,
it's
than,
bigger
that
than that,
because
right.
There's a lot of Black folk, they got a lot of big money,
right.
And the number one state for Black wealth, Maryland. So when you look, Kansas City don't have that. You say, where's mm-hmm. Black wealth in Kansas City? Oh, look on a football team, Tech 9.
Right.
We can't name successful business, doctors, lawyers. We don't have that here.
And that's why we're doing the things we do, you know, so we can see it, so they can actually see what we're doing.
Absolutely.
Todd Kleiman, let me go back to you. You wrote this article 4 years ago. You shared some things that were apparently common knowledge for some people who were sort of insiders in the restaurant world, but not for the rest of us. What has been the repercussions of that? What kind of reactions have you had to that?
Oh, all sorts of reactions. that talk was originally a lecture. It was a lecture I gave in Oxford, Mississippi on the 50th anniversary of the desegregation of the South. Hmm. You know, it was interesting when it came out because when I gave that talk, I as I said, I struggled for close to 10 years at that point to write this piece. Not that I struggled to write it, but that I struggled to find the right audience for it. And I had editors said, well, you can say all these things, you can get into all these things, but you need to have sources who are not going to be anonymous. And you need the points that you want to make, you cannot say them, because you're white and that will be taken as suspect. And so there's a very complicated racial complexity to the media world. In any case, it was something that took a long time to come out. I actually stepped off the stage from that lecture, and I had three offers for the piece. And since the piece came out, it's really made the rounds, but it's been funny to me that people will cherry pick. People will pick and choose from the piece what they want. There are a lot of black folks in the restaurant world who've really seized upon that 60-40 rule because it seems to explain what they want. And then certain other people will kind of ignore the last part of the piece, which gets into kind of an emblematic restaurant in the Washington, D.C. area that has tried to do what very few restaurants do. It's made a very overt attempt to code its space in such a way that it appeals to both white and black, and made overt gestures to a black dining audience. For example, the owner at the time told me, this was many years ago, but he said, you know, we're going to have certain things on the menu, but we're not going to call them by that name because we don't want to be off-putting. We don't want it to be the kind of place where people have to feel that they know what chorizo is. Or, I mean, you know, 6-7 years ago, that was more of a thing. But we don't want them to feel put upon, that they have to have been versed in these sorts of food world terms. We don't want them to feel that this is a space that's not going to be for them. We're going to put hot sauce on the table because that's a cultural signifier. We're going to play a mix of music and at different times of day. And on and on and on, everything was so thought through that this was, to me, an example of a restaurant that was really socially engineered. It was socially engineered to really ride that line between black and white, and it became enormously successful. Right. And a lot of people pointed to it and said, look, it can be done.
Yeah.
And it can be done, but in order for it to be done, it has to be very intentional and almost very self-conscious. And I know a lot of folks in this area turn away from that restaurant because they see it as so self-conscious that it's not natural, and they feel cases pandered to.
I'm curious about that, Reggie. What's your reaction to hearing that? Is it mixed feelings?
Yeah, kind of, just in regards to, first of all, I've been a serial entrepreneur my whole life, so a part of me is listening to this as an entrepreneur.
Right, because you're a businessman, so this is what you do.
Correct. Yeah. So in saying that, when you're building a business, it's your vision, it's your brand, it's how you want to do things. I respect someone who's going to put it together like that, but the reality is it also depends on where you're opening your business, where you live, where you're from. D.C. is a completely different world than a Kansas City.
Yeah.
Atlanta is a completely different world than, than a Texas. Right. So it all depends on
location.
Yeah, your location, the demographics, the state of the people in that area, the education base. It's so complex.
And before we get away from this, before we run out of time, I do want to come back to this location in Kansas City and to what's happening here next week with Restaurant Week. I mean, us a little bit, Quez, about, give me a couple of the restaurants that are participating.
So you can find us on, you can go to the website, KansasCityBlackRestaurantWeek.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. You can see so many, we have interviews with all of these great restaurants, LC's, we have District Biscuit, we have Wing Cafe, we have Nisi's. Go on the website, I don't want to forget anything. Oh, most of all, most importantly, 18th and Vine. We have all of them on 18th and Vine in Kansas City Black Restaurant Week.
Great.
So it's kind of cool. And every day you can look on the website, it's going to tell you each day there's a different restaurant. So I'm excited about that.
And this starts next week from September.
Yeah, September 2nd all the way through September 8th.
And what's the website again?
KansasCityBlackRestaurantWeek.com.
Reggie, how does this fit into this broader picture of black-owned businesses in Kansas City? How important is the restaurant scene?
Brian, you already know I'm just over here shaking with excitement. If y'all could see me out there, just nothing but teeth showing. This for what Black Privilege was founded on, the principles, it was all about increasing the circulation of our money and doing it in an inclusive way.
Right.
So when saying that, what Quez is saying is, anybody out there listening, this is not just for Black people to support Black-owned business. I mean, to support restaurants. Yes. It's for everybody who wants a good meal.
Yes.
Just support one of your favorite Black-owned businesses.
Yes.
That is Reggie Gray, an entrepreneur, a spokesman for the Black Privilege app for Kansas City Black-owned businesses. Quez Beasley is setting up Kansas City Black Restaurant Week. And Todd Kleiman joined us from Washington. He's an author and former food writer. Todd, Quez, Reggie, thanks to all of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
I'm Brian Ellison. We'll be back with more of Central Standard right after this. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. And earlier this week, Gina spoke with Kansas Cityan Brandy Peed about her cat, whose name is Sly James the Cat. Yes, Sly James the Cat. Here's that conversation.
Every day is a holiday, and I don't mean that in a woo-woo daily affirmation kind of way. I'm just stating the facts. In the past week alone, we've already had a National Toilet Paper Day and an International Strange Music Day. And you may think nobody celebrates those holidays. Well, you're wrong. Sly James the Cat celebrates those holidays. He's a tabby, and his owner dresses him up for all of those holidays, then posts pictures on Twitter and Instagram. So let's start at the beginning, shall we? I want to just let our listeners know there is a cat in the studio. And so if you hear some jingling, that's a collar. How did you come to have a cat named Sly James the Cat?
You know, what's funny is when I got him, which was, you know, a friend of mine had posted him on Facebook. Her neighbor was trying to get rid of him, couldn't keep him any longer. And I fell in love with him and then trying to think of a name, and, you know, I thought Kevin Bacon, and I was like, I don't know. I don't think
of course
really...
you thought Kevin Bacon.
I was like, I don't think it really fits him. And, you know, it just kind of hit me. I was like, I really like the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. It's a really unique name, Sly James. And it just kind of fit him.
So you kind of like the celebrity cat name.
I guess a little bit, yeah. I mean, my former cat's name was Pumpkin, so we didn't go with the celebrity name, but it just seemed to really work for him.
Okay. So this cat just seems like famous.
Yeah, or very much like a mayor.
A mayoral cat.
Yeah.
Okay. So what inspired you to start dressing this cat up for holidays? I've seen this cat dressed up for everything from no SpongeBob Day to Bikini Day.
Yeah. So I started this about a little over a year and a half ago, and actually I kind of got the idea from a calendar. There's a company locally in Kansas City that I had bought their planner, and they had funny holidays underneath the dates. And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. And then I was like, maybe that's something I could try with him, like dressing him up every day, not knowing what I was getting myself into.
See, there's quite a following for this now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit surprising. It started out with just like some of my friends, making them laugh, making them smile. You know, with the way the world is right now, you just kind of need a little something to pick you up.
And totally.
I thought, oh, this will be great. And it's blown up. I mean, his birthday was last week and he hit 4,000 followers. And I checked a little bit ago and he's had over 100 followers since last week.
My gosh. Okay. So what was the first costume?
Well, I did New Year's Eve, so it kind of was New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and he didn't really have a costume. I think I had made a funny backdrop and, like, the ball drop. There was a Swiss cheese day, and I think I just made, like, a felt piece of Swiss cheese, and I'm not even sure. It's been so long ago.
Okay, so cats are not notorious for loving to be dressed up, and some of these costumes are elaborate. Sly James the cat has dressed up as Sly James.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell us how you dressed up Sly James the cat as Sly James, the now former mayor, then current mayor.
This cat, he's a big boy. And so I went to a local thrift shop and bought him a size 2T suit.
Oh, my gosh.
And it, you know, obviously it doesn't fit in all the right places. So I've had to pin it and you know, make it fit his body and, you know, then made him a bow tie because, of course, you can't not be Sly James the mayor without a bow tie.
How did you make the bow tie in a way that would, like, evoke mayoral sort of, like, stature but fit a cat?
So you just kind of have to play with it. They have these templates online, and I've, a long time ago, used to actually make bow ties for my former cat. And so I kind of know the sizing anyways, and now I can just do it by hand, you know, like without even doing a template and work on it. But he, I just kind of picked something that's patriotic. You just say, you know, red or blue, I mean, doesn't go wrong.
So, okay, how do you get the cat to comply with all of this? Is that hard or is this cat just like, okay, whatever, this is my deal in life?
He's mostly chill about it, I think. He usually knows when I put up his blue backdrop, it's time to do our photo shoot. And so he'll come over and sit. He only gets really distracted when his brother Bubblegum comes around. And he's pretty good at it.
Is Bubblegum jealous?
I don't think so. Maybe. I call him the manager. So he comes over, checks it out, and either scoots off or whatever, but he, I don't think he's really jealous per se. I mean, maybe if he really knew how many followers Sly had.
Some of your costumes for Sly James the cat on Instagram and Twitter are complicated. Some are simple. One of my favorite recent ones is National Senior Citizen Day. For that, your cat is wearing glasses and what appears to be white hair made of cotton balls. As well as a handmade cardboard walker and a plaid garment of some kind.
Yeah. So the actual garment was like a plaid. I bought it online a long time ago for him. And I switched it around so you could see the little pocket because old men always have like a little pocket that they put little things in. So I switched it around and I made him a little walker. And actually I had to do trial and error on that because getting it the right size and shape and everything. Of course, people commented, where were the, you know, tennis balls? Well, it's hard to find a tennis ball. Or
to scale.
To that size. And you know, a lot of times I'm doing these in the evening and trying to run out and find a tennis ball at, you know, 8 o'clock at night isn't like the best thing
for a self-imposed assignment. Have you ever felt burdened by what you've gotten yourself into with the number of followers?
I feel overwhelmed sometimes. Like, you know, like I said the other day, I mean, he's gained, actually, since he did International Strange Music Day, which featured Tech N9ne, you know, a local KC celebrity, he had a lot of followers, which overwhelmed me. I was like, oh, goodness, more people, which is great. I love it. But also at the same time, I'm like, am I failing in some of these costumes? And, of course, yeah, I have all these people. No, they're so great, which helps.
Yeah, they are pretty elaborate and impressive. Okay, another recent one that I would like to inquire about, Just as an example, National Number 2 Pencil Day.
Yeah.
There's a yellow cat shirt on your cat, and it says number 2 on it, and it looks very DIY, and I think that is as it should be. There's also a hat that looks like the tip of a pencil, a hat just the right size for your cat.
Yeah.
Did you make that?
I did.
It looks super professional.
So most of the stuff I make, probably a good 90 to 95%. And I always use a shirt probably as a basis. I've spent a lot of money at local craft stores, and I own a lot of size 2 t-shirts. If there's a really good one that I've made, I'll keep the shirt and go buy another one. So we have quite a few outfits, right, Si? And, but yeah, I made the top, you know, and it is a little bit of trial and error making sure it's the right size. It's not going to look too big or weird on his head.
So how many of these photos of Sly James the cat are actually paying homage to Sly James the person?
I think there's maybe like 5.
Did he ever interact with the social media accounts dedicated to Sly James the cat? Did Sly James the mayor like ever do a little click a little heart next to something?
I've never seen a heart, but I know there's been a few times that he has said something, or I have friends who have met him and said something about the account, and he's like, oh, yeah, I do know, you know, I do know about my cat, the namesake, or something. When his daughter wrote her book, I bought it, obviously, for the cat named after him, and we read it, and I posted a picture about it, so he knew that his namesake, you know, has a, you know, fondness for his new book.
So he hasn't done like direct engagement with the account, but he knows about it and obviously at least does not mind enough to object.
Right. Yep. I would say so. I mean, if he has, I didn't notice it, but usually, you know, somebody like him or, you know, our now mayor, Quentin Lucas, really loves Sly. Usually those things pop up when I can, you know, and I see that they have engaged. So
how does the election of a new mayor and the change in administration affect you as the keeper of Sly James the cat and his social media profiles?
You know, so many people actually asked me if I was going to change his name, and I was like, well, no. I mean, he's been Sly James for 3 years now. He can't, I'm not going to change his name. You know, I asked, you know, for his birthday some suggestions, and many people said I should get another cat, a kitten, and name him Kitten Lucas.
Kitten Lucas. But then you're sort of like setting a precedent there.
Yeah, I would just have so many cats.
What is your favorite comment anyone has put on any of these pictures? Of all time, favorite of all time, first thing that pops to your head?
I guess probably the most recent would be Strange Music Incorporated, you know, tweeted and Instagrammed and Facebooked about him the other day, and they were like,
"That's Tech Nine's label."
Yes, it's his. Tech Nine's label, and they were like, "This is so incredible." And you know, and somebody else, like Boulevard Brewery, because I made him look like a jam band can. so we've celebrated different beer holidays, and they have commented as well. And so it's kind of neat to see, you know, local people or companies that are, you know, I try to keep things local if I can, just because it's nice to kind of throw back to all, you know, the community. And, you know, we're the mayor of Kata City. We got to show love to all of our people, right?
What has this whole experience done for you, the person behind this whole thing?
It makes me happy that I'm making other people happy. You know, initially I only was going to do this a year, and, you know, it was getting close, and everybody's like, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to keep doing it? And I was like, well, I don't know. It is a lot of work. Usually I'm working on these costumes every day. And I guess because I've had so much feedback positively and so many people follow him, that I know that it's something good out there, and it makes people happy, that it makes me feel happy.
Well, Brandi Peed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mayor Sly James the cat, thank you. I know the cat can't answer me, but he's a cutie.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
That was Central Standard host Gina Kaufman speaking with Brandi Peed about Sly James the cat, who is achieving great celebrity as we speak on Twitter and Instagram. Brandy's hoping to get enough followers, by the way, to earn her cat a spot in a national cat con. So make your way over there, because that apparently is a thing. That's all for today's Central Standard. Tomorrow, Gina Kaufman will be talking with anti-bullying scholar and advocate Sue Ellen Fried about what drives her in her work. And tonight, Gina will be hosting a storytelling event at the Record Bar. It starts at 7. Storytellers include the man behind Manny's on Southwest Boulevard, Kansas City's new mayor, the actual mayor, Quentin Lucas, and a construction worker poet with a voice like Johnny Cash. No cats, though. There's information on our website. It's at kcur.org. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at kcurcst, and I'm at ptsbrian. Central Standards, produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf and Aviva Okeson-Haberman. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Brian Ellison. Stick around for Up to Date next.